Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 39 of our live monthly Q&A with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cinten's. Our speakers today are in front of you. You have Partner and Head of Department Keith Land, and you have, backed by popular demand because she did such a good job in our last outing, Trainee Solicitor Lucy Milnthorpe. As usual, we will be concentrating on three questions that you've put to us throughout the course of the last month, and they are there in front of you. Keith's going to go first. Keith, good morning, and over to you.
Hi, everyone. Morning. First question, what is the position on costs in the Employment Tribunal? Might sound like an obvious question, however, every time a client has a tribunal, we go through this and it'll be surprising. You'll be surprised as to what I don't want to say lack of knowledge, but what limited knowledge there is on this question. Clients come into tribunal litigation often thinking there is an ability to recover costs. Well, there is, but also there isn't. So it seems like an obvious question, but it's one that I frequently have to refresh. Now, any of the tribunal rules are governed by a set of regulations, okay? So if you are a geek and you want to look at these things in your spare time, the place to go if you're looking at if you do a lot of tribunal litigation is the Employment Tribunals Constitution and Rules of Procedure Regulations 2013, and it's Schedule 1, which lists all of the procedural rules that apply in the Employment Tribunal. The starting point is that basically in an employment tribunal, both parties bear their own costs. There are limited exemptions. So in effect, if you are an employer, you dismiss an employee, that employee brings an unfair dismissal claim, and you defend that and lose, well, you pay your own costs to the solicitors that you have or consultants that you have defending you, and you pay the ex-employee some compensation. You lose, okay? Insofar as you dismiss an employee, they bring a claim before the tribunal and you defend that case and you succeed, you don't pay any compensation, but you still do pay your own legal costs. So instead of it being lose, it's just a lose. That is the start of the landscape, really, and it's tough turkey. That's how it sits at the moment. Hence, there is always a financial barrier to conducting employment tribunal litigation. It is different from the civil court, so the county court, the high court, where effectively the loser pays all of the legal costs, both their own and the other side's. So in a sense, there is always a financial barrier to defending an employment tribunal claim. Claimants know this. Hence, you often get people putting in claims after they have probably been fairly dismissed, and an employer has an economic choice to take as to whether they defend that or they sit down and say, well, actually, it's going to cost, always going to cost me some money to defend these proceedings. Why don't we just do a deal? That seems grossly unfair. I get that. I have a lot of frustrated clients that come to us and say, bloody hell, we did everything right. We still have to pay this employee off. It's wrong. Now, I agree with you. I am on your side. Most of our clients are respondents. They are businesses, and that is another cost that they have to take out. I suppose it means you have to get to the position where you manage these things internally so you don't get to the tribunal. Conservative government tried to do something about this, brought in fees in the employment tribunal about 5-6 years ago. There was a judicial review brought by Unison and that overturned the law. It said it was unlawful because it prevents access to justice for people who have lost their job and have no money. And once you've lost your job, you have no money, you can't pay an expensive lawyer to deal with employment tribunal proceedings. And therefore, it denied access to justice, and the Supreme Court threw out the laws that the government brought in. Now, those laws to bring in tribunal fees sort of had tribunal litigation drop off 90% overnight. So that statistic probably tells you something about the veracity and strength of a lot of the claims. Nonetheless, The current position is both parties bear their own costs. There is one limited exemption, okay, and that exists, if you want to look at it, Rule 76, subsection 1 of those Employment Tribunals Constitution and Rules of Procedure Regulations 2013. What a mouthful. I'm going to call them the rules from this point forward, which says if a party acts vexatiously, abusively, disruptively, or otherwise unreasonably in bringing or conducting tribunal proceedings, they can be the subject of a costs application. Okay. The second area where you could, if it bring an application of costs, is where a claim or the response to it has no reasonable prospects of success. Finally, the third area is where there's been a breach of an order. So anyone can apply at any point in time and during any employment tribunal proceedings if they're going to advance one of those arguments. I have to say it's difficult. Less than 1% of cases result in a costs award being made. However, experience shows that the employment tribunal judiciary are warming up to costs award. They are getting much more pragmatic. But you have to have really good grounds. So one, I think really I've been practicing now for 25 years, and I can count on two hands the number of costs award that I've got. So they are infrequent, but they do exist. One we got in recent years is where an employee had brought a claim about health and safety dismissal, but in the course of him giving his evidence, he accepted that he did not raise any issue internally within the business with the health and safety rep. So in giving his oral evidence before the tribunal, he basically took a shotgun and blew his right leg off, and his case collapsed around him. And we made an application. Well, we made an application for costs, and that was successful. But it does show you what somebody has to do to get to that position. However, within the rules also, there are some helpful bits and pieces. There are three other sections. Rule 37, where somebody can apply to strike out a claim where it has no reasonable prospect of success. Okay. I suppose thinking of that, if there were a part of a claim that you thought was rubbish, you could make an application as part of the tribunal litigation, and you could do that at any time. And if you are successful, you've just proved part of the test, haven't you? You've proved that if you get a claim struck out, it must be scandalous, vexatious, or have no reasonable prospect of success. So if we go back to Rule 76.1 that says somebody's acted unreasonably in bringing or conducting the proceedings, you have an automatic tick there in the box to apply for a costs award. Similarly, within the rules, you can apply for an unless order. Rule 38, an unless order is where somebody is not complying with tribunal orders along the proceedings, or they're late on them, and you apply to the tribunal to say, well, unless they comply with that order in the next 2 days or the next 2 weeks, the tribunal should strike out the claim. Tribunals are reluctant to do it, but if somebody is a repeat offender, they may issue an unless order. Once again, to get to that point, if you go back to Rule 76.1, if an unless order is issued, it means that somebody has breached tribunal orders along the way. And if you go back to Rule 76.1, the third ground was there's a breach of an order. So again, if that happens, you've got a pretty good chance of getting a costs award made. Latterly, there is Rule 39, which also then says if an argument or part of the claim has no reasonable prospect of success, a party can apply to the employment tribunal to force the other sides to pay a sum of money into the tribunal, i.e. it can only be up to £1,000. But what the tribunal is then saying is it doesn't have belief in that argument or that defence. And so if a claimant or a respondent is insisting on running that argument, the tribunal thinks it's so weak, they force them to put some money in on account of the cost order. Again, if you get that kind of order, I would automatically then be jumping back and saying, well, hold on a minute. Under Rule 76.1, somebody must be behaving unreasonably to even have the tribunal consider making a deposit order. Their arguments must be rubbish, for want of a better phrase. And consequently, I would automatically be making an application for costs. Ultimately, really difficult. Okay, less than 1% of cases, but tribunals are warming up to it, and you can do it if there are strong enough grounds. I think I've done that to death, Lucy, so I'm going to pass you over. And I think you're going to talk about deductions and national minimum wage.
Thanks, Keith. So, morning, everyone. The question that I'm doing is whether an employer can make a deduction from an employee's wages if this would reduce their earnings below national minimum wage. So the broad answer to this question is yes, but it depends what the deduction is in relation to. So as an employer, you may make a deduction from an employee's wages for a number of reasons. This could be to pay for training courses that they've done, or to pay for their uniform or new equipment and things like that. So in any event, regardless of minimum wage considerations, the first question when deducting from an employee's wages will always be to make sure whether that the deduction is lawful, because we certainly want to avoid any claims for unlawful deductions from wages. So firstly, you must always check whether you have the right to make the deduction in the first place. This may be by prior written agreement from the employee, for example, under a training costs agreement, or hopefully the permission is made clear in their contract of employment. So once you've checked this and you are permitted to make the deduction, this is when the national minimum wage considerations can come in. So if an employee is paid national minimum wage or close to minimum wage, then there needs to be this extra consideration as to whether the deduction will bring them below this threshold. And even employees who are paid quite above minimum wage, if the deduction is significant, it could still bring them below, meaning that these considerations will come into play. So there are five types of deductions which can be made, even if it would bring the employee below minimum wage, because these are essentially ignored for the purposes of calculating whether the employee's remuneration amounts to national minimum wage. So this means that as an employer, you will comply with the law as long as they're paid before the deduction meets the threshold. So the first type of deduction which is ignored is where the deduction is in respect of the worker's conduct or any other event for which the worker is contractually liable. So what does this mean? This essentially means that provided there's a clause which permits the deduction in the employee's contract, this deduction can be made even if it would bring their pay below minimum wage. So an example of this could be where an employee damages company property and there's a clause in their contract which states that they are liable for any such damage. And the reference under this exception to or any other event has been interpreted to mean that it simply needs to just have a relationship to conduct for which the employee is responsible. So it doesn't necessarily have to amount to misconduct to fall within this category. Therefore, the questions to ask yourself when making a deduction under this category is the employee liable under the contract to pay for whatever it is you are making the deduction for? And is this deduction to do with the employee's conduct or any other event that is provided for in their contract? So that covers the first type of deduction. And the rest of the deductions are pretty self-explanatory, so I can go through these fairly quickly. So the second type of deduction, which is ignored, is where there's a loan agreement between the employer and the employee, or there has been an advancement of wages given by the employer. So deduction from wages to cover these things are allowed, even if it would bring them below national minimum wage as a result. The third type of deduction is where there's been an accidental overpayment of the employee's wages 1 month. So this overpayment can therefore be recovered even if it would bring them below national minimum wage in following months. The fourth type of deduction, which is ignored, is to cover where an employee's purchased shares or other securities from their employer. And the fifth is where an employer is where an employee has purchased goods or services from their employer, unless this purchase has been made in order to comply with a requirement imposed by the employer in connection with the worker's employment. So they are the five types of deductions which can be made even if it would bring the employee below national minimum wage. This means that any deductions for things which don't fall within these categories may not be made if the employee would be taken below minimum wage. So this could include compulsory training courses, uniforms which are mandatory, and essential tools for doing their job essentially. So our advice to employers is to check whether you were permitted to make the deduction in the first place, whether by written agreement or under their contract of employment. Assess whether the deduction that you plan to make is going to take them below minimum wage. And if this is the case, then consider whether the deduction falls within one of these five exceptions that can be made. If it does, then you're fine. But if it doesn't, then the deduction cannot be made. So that covers everything from me today. So I'll pass you back to Keith for our final question. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Lucy. Okay, final question. Is an employee entitled to a bonus whilst on maternity leave? Maternity leave has been around for donkey's years now, but this is still a pretty challenging question. And the short answer is it's all a bit still up in the air, to be perfectly honest with you, which is all very employment law, isn't it? So where do we start? Okay, well for any woman that is on maternity leave, you've got to start with the legislation. If you've got section 71 subsection 4 and section 73 subsection 4 of the Employment Rights Act and regulation 9 subsection 1 of the Maternity and Parental Leave Regulations 1999. Okay, these provide that a woman is entitled to the benefit of all of her terms and conditions of employment that would apply during maternity leave I'll start again because I've made a right pig's ear of it, but never mind. A woman is entitled to the benefit of all of her terms and conditions that would have applied had she been at work and not been on maternity leave. Hopefully that's clear. So she's also bound by any obligations under her terms and conditions of employment, except where they are inconsistent with her taking maternity leave. Just to confirm, that all seems pretty clear, which would suggest that terms and conditions apply and therefore bonus would be payable. However, the definition of terms and conditions of employment for the purpose of the pieces of legislation, for the purpose of maternity leave, is all matters connected with employment except for remuneration. Okay, so the answer to this question really depends on what amounts to remuneration for the purposes of the maternity leave regulations. And Regulation 9.3 of the Maternity and Parental Leave Regulations 1999 indicates that only wages and salary amount to remuneration, which suggests that, therefore, okay, wages and salary are effectively excluded, okay? All other contractual benefits apply, okay? Now, that means things like life assurance and stuff like that need to be provided to somebody whilst they're on maternity leave. But where does a bonus sit? Because in effect, as wages and salary equal remuneration and they are then excluded from being paid to a woman under the statutory scheme. Obviously, you can decide to do differently under your contracts of employment if you want to do so, but I'm talking about the statutory scheme here. So does a bonus fall under the definition of being remuneration, thus being wages and salary, and therefore is it excluded? Well, the answer is given in a case called Hoyland versus Asda Stores, where this case really involved a bonus for work and it was for work that was done during the financial year. Employee was absent on maternity leave, and then the question arose as to whether that person would still be entitled to the bonus. The outcome of the case was such that where the bonus is there to reward performance during a financial year, but the employee is not present because of maternity leave, then they are effectively not entitled to be paid for the period whilst they're on maternity leave. And as a consequence, you end up in a position where if during a financial year, a woman is in work for part of the year and out of work for the remainder of the year, and there is a performance related bonus, you would have to effectively calculate the bonus based on the assumption that she would have been there for the entire year and then prorate it for the period that she was actually at work and performing during that year. So if she's been there for half the year, she would get half of the standard bonus. A couple of exceptions to that. There is obviously the compulsory maternity leave period, which is the 2-week window immediately following when a woman has a child. The impact of the compulsory maternity leave period is that a woman should be treated as if she is at work, and so she will always be entitled to bonus for that period. It's only a 2-week window, despite the fact that she's not there and working. The only other exception really to the rule is where a bonus is paid out and it's not related to performance during the financial year. So for example, a bonus paid at Christmas, a Christmas bonus, people might not have them anymore, or there may be few of them around, but if that is doled out to everybody, irrespective of length of service, irrespective of financial performance of the individual during the financial year, they would get that despite being on maternity leave, because they're entitled to all of the other terms and conditions of employment and it's not related to performance. Similarly, if you have made a cost of living payment to people and you've given that to given the cost of living crisis, if you've made a cost of living payment to everybody and that is given out to everybody of the business irrespective, then that is not related to performance. So again, a woman would be entitled to that despite being off on maternity leave. I think that is probably the most simple way of putting it, in that, in summary, bonuses payable during mat leave, bonuses not payable during mat leave, where it is related to performance, and actually you would then prorate that for the year, taking into account the period where a woman had been off as a consequence of a maternity leave. I think that's us done for the day. David, I'm going to pass back to you to wrap up.
Thanks very much to both of you. Enjoyed listening to that one as always. I've just put the guys' details back on the screen there. If you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today further, please don't hesitate to get in touch with either of them or both of them. Just quickly, we continue to work hard to produce, deliver and release relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, webinars, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all 39 episodes in about half an hour of this employment Q&A. There's also a wealth of employment related content that's on the website that's really, really worth checking out. And if you want to hear even more from us, you can check us out on Twitter at SintonsHR. So with Christmas being next month, we are going to slightly amend the schedule. So if we were going to record on the last working Friday, I think that would probably make it the 23rd, which we're not going to do. So we're going to bring it a week forward. Keith's nodding, so that's okay. I did check that with him yesterday. That's okay. We are going to do that. So we'll be with you on the third working Friday of December. And as usual, I will send the link round for you to join just before. We were just frightening Lucy just before we went on with the amount of people that are online again today, and it's another record number. So just taking a second just to thank everyone for continuing to tune in. This series is just continues to grow and grow and grow. So we are delighted. We are delighted that it continues to add value to you. So thank you for tuning in. That's enough for me. We will speak to you next month. Enjoy December, everybody, and we'll speak to you next month. Take care.